Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program covering news and ideas from Central California. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, one of the nastiest fights over intellectual property in the nation is brewing in the most unlikely of places, Yosemite National Park. Who owns the names of iconic Yosemite features like the Ahwahnee Hotel and Wawona Hotel? It's a legal fight involving a $2 billion deal to run Yosemite concessions, and the renaming of those icons is just weeks away from reality. We'll get an insider's view from the man who used to run Yosemite, Robert Benoist, and learn why he says he was pushed out of his job decades ago. That and the future of Kern Medical Center may look a lot different than its past. We'll talk to the hospital CEO, Russell Judd. Right now, though, we turn our attention to an issue that we don't normally think of when we think of fabric or Valley agriculture, and that's counterfeit goods. Americans come into contact with cotton every day. It's a staple we use for clothing, food products, and even cosmetics. But not all cotton is of equal quality. Much of what's grown here in Central California is of the highly prized Pima variety, known for its softness and its high price. But many times, high-grade cotton fabrics have been laced with inferior fibers. FM 89's Ezra David Romero reports on how the cotton industry discovered the problem and how they're fighting back.
American Pima cotton is claimed as some of the finest cotton in the world. Debbie Fletcher only buys cotton products made out of the plant.
The feel of the fabric is very silky. My husband had a polo shirt made with this, and I kind of commandeered it as a nightgown.
Fletcher's a housewife in Fresno. She says the larger price tag for the Pima sheets and shirts she wears is worth it.
I'm kind of like the princess and the pea when it comes to sleeping. I feel everything. Feels like you're in a luxury hotel with these sheets. I don't have any sheets that are not Pima cotton.
People like Fletcher are David Greenstein's target audience. He sells Pima cotton sheets to retailers like Costco. He has a lot riding on ensuring his customers are happy. They were until he got a call in early 2014.
The customer called me and said, "Do you know that this product that you're supplying us is not 100% pure?" We were unaware. We thought we were innocent. So we said, "That can't be."
It turns out his expensive sheets weren't entirely Pima. Somewhere in the supply chain, someone was mixing in lower quality cotton and advertising it as higher quality fabric. That's a big problem for Greenstein because his textile company sells bedding labeled 100% Pima. At first, Greenstein didn't believe the claim, but new technology from a company called Applied DNA Sciences gave the retailer proof. They came up with a way to test cotton fabric for the exact types of fiber used to create it.
And then we started to understand how this DNA fiber typing works, and then we realized it was true.
Greenstein says this DNA technology is a big deal. It has the potential to force the textile industry to rethink how existing supply chains work. He immediately knew where the problem was in his supply chain. Chinese spinners. They turn cotton into thread.
We had to get them to admit that they were doing something wrong. And then we had to get them to agree that it was time to change and to buck an industry trend.
So we hopped on a plane to China with a delegation of farmers, scientists, and retailers to confront the company that was selling the bogus thread. When they arrived, they presented their findings. When you finished your presentation, was it kind of eerie in that moment when they were gathering their thoughts?
They asked for a time. And they left us in the room and went to talk among themselves. And then they came back and told us that they were ready to admit to certain things.
They only agreed because Greenstein and his crew told them that changes coming would make it harder to cheat in the thread-making process. Applied DNA Sciences helped again by taking an existing system used to catch criminals and applying that same technology to cotton. It's a botanical DNA serum that's mixed with water. This process starts back in the Central Valley, where Kirk Gilkey grows Pima cotton in Kings County. he also stands to lose if Pima cotton sheets aren't entirely what they're claimed to be. He says Pima cotton's higher price is what's keeping his family farm afloat.
It's given us our only chance over the years. If I wasn't growing Pima, I wouldn't be in the cotton business anymore.
He says the higher price of Pima is enough to offset the cost of water and the lure of other crops. Otherwise, he'd have to be like the other farmers who have had to leave the business altogether. That's why he's on board with the DNA tagging. The process starts like this. After the cotton is harvested, it's packed into huge rectangles that look like giant sticks of butter from the roadside. It's then trucked to his gin, where a pipe sucks the cotton into his factory. A series of ceiling-high machines, dryers, and saws rid the cotton of sticks, dirt, and seeds. At the end of the process, this newly white cotton is sprayed with a DNA serum in the form of fog. Jim Hayward leads Applied DNA Sciences.
That binds permanently to the cotton fiber. That allows us to track it to a point of origin, to say, this comes from the San Joaquin Valley.
It's then compacted into 500-pound bales and shipped to China. Now when this cotton is turned into thread and fabric, they'll be able to know exactly what farm it came from.
Typical bale can produce as many as 3,400 pairs of socks or 750 shirts or 200 full-size bed sheets.
Today, a number of other California growers tag their cotton with this DNA serum, and Greenstein's company is using that cotton to make sheets. It's now on sale under the brand PimaCot at Costco. So I decided to buy a set myself.
I'm looking for the Pima cotton sheets, the Pima cot version.
They're right up here on your right.
How much are they? They're $58.99?
$58.99 for queen and $69.49 for the king.
To prove that these sheets are as good as their makers claim, I brought them to someone who knows a lot about fabric.
Wow, it's very luxurious. Feels just like a silk.
Liju Davis runs a fashion merchandising program at Fresno State.
It's a pretty good quality, and it's a very, sorry, I'm looking at the quality of the sheets. Look at this.
Davis liked the sheets so much that she wanted to take mine home.
So are you going to go buy some Pima Cotton Kirkland Signature sheets?
Yeah, you make me so curious. I really love what I feel.
Davis hopes the use of DNA technology to track products globally is just the beginning of change in her industry. She suspects this DNA tagging system could also be used on silk and synthetic materials. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Last month, National Park Service officials made headlines when they announced their plan to remove the historic names from many of Yosemite National Park's treasured amenities, like the Awani Hotel and Curry Village. It sparked a public outcry. It was a bold move in a legal dispute that's ongoing between the government, outgoing Yosemite concessions company Delaware North, and Aramark, which is set to take over operations next month thanks to a new $2 billion concessions contract. Delaware North says it owns the old names and wants Aramark to pay over $50 million for the rights to use them. It's all the subject of the ongoing lawsuit. Delaware North says it even trademarked the name Yosemite National Park itself. But what does this say about the commercialization of our national parks and specifically the way Yosemite is run? That issue is one that's been the topic of controversy for decades, and no one knows that more than our next guest. Robert Benoist was the superintendent of Yosemite from 1979 to 1986, and he has a new book out about the park, his controversial tenure there, and its future. Mr. Benoist, welcome to Valley Edition.
Well, thank you very much.
This issue of intellectual property, Delaware North says it goes way back to when they took over for the Curry Company. You dealt with the Curry Company during your tenure at Yosemite. What was the situation with the names back then? And was this ever something that was considered that a private company would trademark these sorts of names?
Well, to put this in perspective, I think first it's well to recall that these names, these historic names in Yosemite, go back for many, many, many years. I think starting with the granddaddy of them all, the Wawona Hotel, that was named that by Mrs. Henry Washburn in 1884. So these are all historic names that we have all known for years. I don't think anyone anticipated that a company would try to trademark these names, as you point out, including the name Yosemite National Park, which Delaware North claims it has trademarked to be used on T-shirts and coffee mugs and other commercial products that it develops. So I think the idea of these trademark names came as a great surprise to everyone. Delaware North apparently went through a legal process in about 2003 to gather the trademarks together. That was a legal process, but it was also a very quiet process. No one was really paying attention, so to speak. And so when Delaware North subsequently claimed that these names are worth millions of dollars and that the new concessionaire Aramark should pay for them, everyone was startled.
I've heard some people suggest that essentially by announcing this name change, the National Park Service and Aramark are in some ways calling Delaware North's bluff, saying, okay, if you're going to play hardball, here's our move. Those names really aren't worth all that much to you if no one is using them, and leaving open the possibility that the name change to these new, rather generic-sounding names could be relatively temporary if some sort of a deal is reached, maybe getting down that $50 million asking price.
Well, you know, and I think most of us hope that the bluff will be called. It's going to be pretty amazing if the Ahwahnee Hotel is changed to the Majestic Yosemite Hotel as proposed, and that these other names are going to be changed. From my perspective, and I think this perspective is shared by a lot of people, it would be well to pull this whole issue out of the courts. Have the parties sit down around a table and come to an agreement on how to get this resolved in a way that will protect the historic names in Yosemite.
I think a lot of people here in Central California who visit Yosemite regularly would be somewhat surprised to know that it really is a big business involved in operating these concessions. How much of that is the problem here? There's a lot of money, a lot of corporate assets at stake, a lot of corporate interests at stake here. When we're really thinking about the national parks, most of the time we think about the public trust and this is the people's place. How do you see that as it evolved over Yosemite's tenure with the Curry Company and then now these mega corporations?
You're so right. I think most people see Yosemite as a combination of wonderful values. It's an immense nature preserve. As we all know, it's a absolutely spectacular natural art piece, and it's a historic and cultural gem, all these things rolled into one, a real public treasure. But it also happens to be, and has been from the start, an economic engine of considerable scale. You mentioned that the current 15-year contract that the company Aramark will be taking over on March 1st is estimated to be worth $2 billion. That's a billion, like with a B at the beginning. And so Yosemite from the start has been involved in this contest between nature preservation and economic development. During my tenure at Yosemite, we approved something called the 1980 General Management Plan, which was a fairly substantive attempt to draw a bright line between commercial activity in the park and the overriding responsibility to preserve the natural beauty of Yosemite. We were able to accomplish that. In 1980, that plan was put on the shelf for many, many years to come. More recently, the National Park Service has been able to take that plan a step further and actually establish a use capacity in Yosemite Valley of about 18,000 people per day on a heavily traveled day in the summertime to really contain the commercial pressure that has always existed within the park and try to encourage further commercialism to be developed beyond the park boundaries in the gateway communities. That's an ongoing contest. There doesn't seem to be an immediate end in sight. This whole name change controversy is just one example of companies that are trying to, quote, cash in, unquote, on the fame of Yosemite.
How do you think the park is faring when it comes to limiting that capacity?
When I was serving in Yosemite in the 1980s, the annual visitation to the park was about 2 million people per year. And we were suffering traffic gridlock even in those days. The current level of visitation in Yosemite is 4 million people per year. So visitation has doubled in the park since the approval of the 1980 plan. Yosemite Valley is 7 miles long and about a mile wide. It's a 7-square-mile area, really a very small part of the overall park. It has to have a use capacity, just like any other popular venue in the United States, whether to stretch the analogy, whether it's a football stadium or an opera house or a basketball arena. These places have a use capacity, and Yosemite Valley is just the same. You cannot continue to cram more and more people into a place like that and still expect visitors to have the kind of experience that we all would want when we're visiting a place like Yosemite.
If you just joined us today on Valley Edition, we're talking with former Yosemite National Park Superintendent Robert Benoist. He ran the park from 1979 to 1986. He has a new book out about the park, Your Yosemite, talking about his tenure there, the history of the park, and its future stewardship. We're talking about this, of course, in the context of this controversy over the potential renaming of many of Yosemite's most historic man-made attractions, including the Ahwahnee Hotel and the Wawona Hotel, as part of this change in the Park Service concessionaire. How much can something like politics play a role in the position of being Yosemite superintendent? You were on the inside. You saw how something like this works. Is that a concern still today?
I think that absolutely is a concern. I think it has been. In my own case, I experienced that to the hilt, and I think that politics is always there. There is always a need to convince and inform and educate elected officials, public officials, about the history of a place like Yosemite, how it came to be, what the problems are at the moment, and what our responsibility as stewards is to pass on a place like Yosemite to people yet to come.
You mentioned that you saw those political pressures. In what way?
Well, I was selected as superintendent of Yosemite by Bill Whalen, who was the director of the National Park Service at the time. And that was during the Carter administration. I came to Yosemite. We were working on the 1980 general management plan when the political ground shifted. Ronald Reagan was elected president. He, by the way, seemed to be a person that really appreciated Yosemite and had camped in the backcountry. But he appointed someone named James Watt to be Secretary of the Interior. And very soon after that, Bill Whalen was removed as director of the National Park Service. One of the reasons given at the time, reported at the time, was that Bill Whalen was too eager to establish strong preservation controls in Yosemite and to reduce the commercial impact in the park. Bill Whalen left. As director, I stayed there, and despite those developments, we were able to get the 1980 plan approved. I stayed in the park until 1986, when I also was ordered to leave the park and go to another job in a regional office in San Francisco.
Your departure from Yosemite that you just mentioned, it was not a planned one. It was not a pleasant one. You surreptitiously recorded a conversation with a park critic, which led to your reassignment to that job. You've had a lot of time to reflect on that. Do you think there were other motives at play? Was that just the story that was put out? Looking back on it now, how do you see it?
I've always thought that there was something else there. I freely admit that I made a real blunder. I didn't do anything that was illegal, but ethically, I made a blunder by recording a conversation with a park critic. That alone, conversation was recorded in 1983, and it wasn't until 3 years later that the issue was brought up again, and I was invited to leave my post at Yosemite. Other people, news reporters, have suggested that there was another agenda there. I've always kind of assumed that there was another agenda, but I've never been able to find out any of the real details.
Gene Rose had a column in the Fresno Bee a couple of weeks ago talking about the connections between Ronald Reagan's former agent and MCA, which at that point was running the Curry Company. Do you think that was part of the issue?
I've always suspected that there was something there, yes.
Do you think there's a better way to deal with these issues of these park concessioners? They certainly wield a lot of power. There's a lot of money there. There are important services to provide, but also those services, as we talked about, have costs as well to the environment, to the park experience. Is there some better way that we aren't looking at right now?
If I could wave my magic wand, I would cause all the commercial operations inside national parks to become not-for-profit corporations so that when people purchase services within a place like Yosemite, the proceeds from that purchase will be recycled to benefit the park rather than be sent off to distant shareholders who may have no interest in the park or its legacy. This is not a radical idea. There have been not-for-profits operating in national parks for decades. We were successful during my tenure at Yosemite in initiating what is now a not-for-profit corporation called the Yosemite Conservancy that does a very, very fine job of raising funds for the park to support education and scientific inquiry and restoration of habitat and protection of historic structures. To me, it's not a difficult step to think that we could move from the small not-for-profits that are operating within the national parks to not-for-profits that actually manage concession activities. There are not-for-profits that manage the Mayo Clinic and Stanford University and many, many other large organizations, and I think that not-for-profit would be fully capable of managing something like the Ahwahnee Hotel and then returning the proceeds from that for care of the park. And I think in so doing, there would be a reduction of the conflict between preservation and commercialism in the park.
Robert Benoist was the superintendent of Yosemite National Park from 1979 to 1986. He has a new book out about his tenure there, as well as the park's future. It's called Your Yosemite. In fact, it's been updated online, the ebook version, with new information about this current naming controversy. Mr. Benoist, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're certainly welcome. Thank you.
And stay with us. We'll be back with more of Valley Edition in just a moment.
And All Things Considered's story starts with the news.
Two women set to become the first female Army Rangers ever.
That day, we wanted to follow it with a conversation from a woman who was in the military.
So we just email everybody.
Whittle it down to one. We get her on the phone.
Welcome to the program, Sergeant Marquez.
Thank you very much, Audie.
I want to start just with your reaction.
There's more to every story on All Things Considered every afternoon.
You're listening to Valley Edition. How much privacy would you be willing to hand over to a police department in exchange for a promise of increased safety? Some say the Fresno Police Department is testing the very limits of that question with their new real-time crime center. FM89's Jeffrey Hess reports that while technology can help, it may also have limits.
There's a scene in the popular Batman movie, The Dark Knight, where Batman turns every cell phone in Gotham into one super surveillance network to help him hunt the Joker.
You took my sonar concept and applied it to every phone in the city. With half the city feeding you sonar, you can image all of Gotham.
That is partly what I was expecting when I met Sergeant Steve Casto in the real-time crime center in the Fresno Police Headquarters. I found something much less superhero and more nerdy. Casto says when he started his career, it was all about being in the field. He never expected to monitor the city from behind a desk.
You joke about that all the time, that I can't believe I'm here and they didn't teach any of this in the academy.
Casto oversees the technicians, mostly former cops or injured officers, who sit behind banks of monitors scanning all the information coming in from more than the 1,000 calls they get every day. Large TVs line the walls displaying live footage from hundreds of cameras around Fresno. A map tracks the position of every officer, and microphones around town listen for gunshots. The center collects tons of data all in one place. But unlike Batman, they are not using cell phones as sonar. And the inside is as quiet as a church. When a call comes in, a technician sees it on a map, aggregates all the information they can access, and shares it with the officer in the field.
And there's one that just came in. You heard the alert, new call holding. That alerts them there's a new call holding. One of the operators in the center can then assign themselves to this call, take a look at that call, and then determine what they can offer the responding officers.
The department extolled the advantages of speed and information the real-time crime center provides. The details can be relayed to officers to ideally avoid the kind of miscommunication that led, in part, to the fatal shooting of a 12-year-old boy with a toy gun in Cleveland, Ohio. Casto says the center is highly effective. One example he points to is a case where an officer got into a physical confrontation with a suspect who was unable to reach his microphone to call for help.
However, the operator in the center, observing all this, saw that he was calling for help, needed help, and then was able to come over the radio and get him the help he needed to resolve the incident.
The department has been aggressive in their use of electronic surveillance and information, and in many cases is leading the way in modern policing. But that ambition has twice gotten them into hot water with civil liberties and privacy advocates. Matt Cagle, an attorney with the ACLU, uncovered emails of the department testing a social network monitoring tool that advertised broad search capabilities.
Including a tool that encourages surveillance of hashtags like Black Lives Matter, Don't Shoot, and I'm Unarmed.
In November, it was revealed that the department was using a third-party software to assign color-coded threat assessments when responding to calls. Both of those programs have since been shelved. Cagle says the department has been too aggressive and secretive with how it is applying electronic surveillance software.
The real issue here is that law enforcement went and adopted and started using these technologies without looping in the public about these surveillance proposals and the proper safeguards and oversight that should be in place. So whether or not the community is okay with this should be up to the community, not law enforcement to make as a decision in secret.
Sergeant Casto acknowledges that the department should have been more upfront in what they were doing. If any of the programs are revived, he says they will explain it to City Council. However, he remains adamant that the department should be monitoring the internet and social media like Facebook and Twitter for signs of criminal activity. The evidence of how useful the cameras, internet searches, and other high-tech surveillance are is mixed, says former prosecutor and Stanford law professor David Sklansky. He says there is some research that shows cameras help reduce crime by securing convictions and deterring potential criminals. There is less research on the quality of information gleaned from social media, although it is currently legal for a department to do so. However, he says police departments need to be wary of being seduced by the latest shiny technology.
There's always a danger that technology can seem fun and sexy and easy. And a lot of what we know is really important in policing is the hard work of getting out and getting to know the community, being in dialogue with the community.
But all three men agree on one thing. The community at large is going to have to be more involved going forward when deciding how much privacy they're willing to sacrifice in the name of public safety. After all, real life is not an action movie, and Batman isn't answering the call in Fresno anytime soon. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to Valley Edition. What's in a name? A lot, apparently, especially when it comes to the world of healthcare. Kern County's longtime public hospital, Kern Medical Center, now has a new name and a new operator, a new hospital authority. This comes at the same time as safety net hospitals across the state are facing new pressures when it comes to costs and care in the new era with the Affordable Care Act. Here to tell us more about the new Kern Medical is hospital CEO Russell Judd. Mr. Judd, welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you today.
First of all, let's just start out with the new name. Why the name change, or why change Kern Medical Center to simply Kern Medical?
Well, as you know, healthcare is constantly changing. That's one thing constant in our life, and that is change. And as we embarked on the turnaround here at Kern Medical and all the other changes that we've made, we wanted to identify a name. We wanted to identify a brand. We wanted our identity to match the wonderful care and the great service that we provide up here at the hospital.
What does that mean? How does that happen?
Well, Kern Medical Center began in almost 150 years ago and was under the name of Kern General Hospital. Over time, as changes were brought about, it evolved to Kern Medical Center. And this is a symbolic way of us communicating and telling the world that we've taken that very next step, that we are something new, we are something different. We're providing a higher level of service. While we're still the safety net care provider in the community, we're also the tertiary or third level of care for the community. And changing the name, identifying this new brand, telling the story is just part of this evolution as we continue to improve and become something new.
And in the interest of disclosure, Kern Medical Center is an underwriter on Valley Public Radio, as many other hospitals are. Looking at this change, you're also changing the way the hospital operates from a governance standpoint. How significant is that, and why make that move?
Again, this is part of our change, and this is very significant. For the 150 years, it's been owned and operated by the County of Kern, and we began about 24 months ago a process to form what is called a hospital authority. What that means is that it is a designation by the state of California. We had legislation passed that created another public entity called an authority. It's given the authority by the state of California to operate a hospital. The authority was enacted by an ordinance passed by the Kern County Board of Supervisors. And on July 1st, the hospital, its building, its employees, its liabilities, as well as its opportunities, every aspect will be transferred from the legal entity of the County of Kern to this new entity called the Kern County Hospital Authority.
What does that mean for the hospital's finances? In recent memory, the hospital has had some budget problems. The residents of Kern County have had to extend loans to help the hospital. Certainly things have improved in recent months. The county still has money involved. What's that going to be like going forward?
So the county of any county in the state of California still has a requirement by state law to care for the medically indigent adults. That population that don't qualify for Medi-Cal and are at a certain poverty level, the County of Kern will continue to have that responsibility. In the past, they met that obligation by operating the hospital. Unfortunately, the hospital fell upon some hard times. There are some difficult circumstances here. And in addition to just meeting that obligation, they were having to make up tens of, 2 years ago, $30 million worth of operational shortfalls. Since then, we have changed the operating model of the hospital, of course, with the new management team, and we've stemmed those tides. The county of Kern is now only contributing $7 million. As we go forward, we will enter into yearly negotiations with the county to cover that responsibility of medically indigent adults. But as we step into the authority, the county will no longer be that, the burden of an unsuccessful hospital will no longer sit on the taxpayers' back. Any of the general fund, other than this obligation to cover the medically indigent adults, no dollars from the general fund will be used to operate the hospital.
So it sounds like that might give you more freedom to do new things, but also that would be a much more responsibility on the hospital authority's part in managing this facility. So is that part of the move to do some new things?
That's absolutely correct. Stepping away from the county does free us up from some of the bureaucracies that exist in county government that are very appropriate for the typical county departments, a health and human services, a fire department, a sheriff. When you need, a marriage license, you've got to go down to the county and see if they're the sole provider of those services. Whereas in healthcare, we are not the sole provider of healthcare. So many of those burdens that are placed upon a county government had been applicable to the hospital. Our budget's just under $300 million a year. And the county, as I mentioned, this year is contributing $7 million of that. But to then put all of those bureaucracies, the civil service, the procurement, so many of those government processes on the back of the hospital really handcuffed us a little bit. So as we step away, we'll be free to move in a direction that we need to be able to move, free up, and be able to be a little bit more nimble, and which we think in the end run will allow us to be more financially solid.
Kern Medical CEO Russell Judd is with us today on Valley Edition. This new era that we're in with the expansion of Medi-Cal and coverage under the Affordable Care Act has changed the number of people who were, as you said earlier, medically indigent, people who in the past would rely on Kern Medical services. It's also changed the way hospitals like Kern Medical receive payment from the state. Essentially, now you're competing for customers in an era in the past when you didn't, or at least not in the same way. How have things changed along those lines for a hospital like Kern Medical?
So with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and California's implementation of that, they expanded those individuals that were eligible for Medi-Cal. What qualifies you for that is now much broader, and there's been a significant larger number of people who now qualify for that. The other hospitals in the community receive payment for those Medi-Cal patients and are now opening their doors to those patients where previously they haven't been opened. And so we have to have a service level. We have to provide a quality of care. We have to provide a physical facility of what the community expects. And so that those patients who have traditionally been our patients continue, now that they have a choice, to choose Kern Medical as their health care provider.
So with the new name and all these changes that you're talking about, clearly you're trying to reach out to people who might not have considered Kern Medical in the past for care. Your hospital has a reputation as being, where you go when there's trauma, where you go when you are in that sort of a situation. How do you try to reach those people when in the past they've gone to these other facilities and Kern Medical is thought of as more of that safety net hospital? How do you do that? I mean, one way is putting a new name, but I imagine it takes more than just a name to change habits like that. Those are things that can be challenging sometimes.
And the best way for me to answer that is we focus on what our mission is. Our mission is we're kind of a twofold mission. One, we are the safety net provider. The other is we play that role of the tertiary center. We are where the high-risk deliveries come. We're when the hip replacement has failed the first time and the second one needs to be done. We are the trauma. We also have the only inpatient medically-based psychiatric unit in the community. And so our brand name was really not to bring in new customers, but it was to tell the story that we're already providing. our mission and our goals and our objectives are not to be and compete, or if that's the word to you, with the other community hospitals. We're not trying to have the healthy people, the normal newborns, or that first-time hip replacement, or the simple pneumonias come to our facility. Our mission is those two aspects. It's the safety net. We're very proud of the mission that we fulfill, that we know nobody will fall through the cracks in our community, that we're here to catch them, and then we provide that higher level of service. And so our brand is really about telling the message that we've already have and the great service that we're providing. So we're not out there trying to take the typical community hospital patients away from the other healthcare providers in the community. We just want to tell the story of what our mission is, and that's that twofold. We're that tertiary or higher level of care as well as a safety net provider.
About how big is the medically indigent population in Kern County now that we have seen Medi-Cal expand and those things? Certainly there are individuals that don't qualify for Medi-Cal, folks who might have immigration status that doesn't allow them to qualify, undocumented immigrants, others who haven't enrolled. Do you have an estimate of how large that population that still needs that safety net care is?
You know, that for literally as we're in negotiations with county, that's the million-dollar question that we have. We don't have that number. Now, we're trying to gather that as people come into our emergency department and they're coming into our clinics. The big moving target in this, as you mentioned, is the undocumented. It's a transient society. When they're here in our community, we're here to provide care for them. And so capturing that real number is a very difficult. And we don't have a good handle yet on what that population number is.
It's been a couple of years now since we've seen the rollout of the expansion of coverage. How have you seen that change in terms of your patient visits, your patient loads?
So we've had extreme growth in our outpatient clinic visits or our doctor office visits. And so that is the best place for health care to be provided, is in a doctor's office, not in the emergency department. So thankfully, we've seen a decrease of the non-emergent cases in our emergency department. And now, with them having an ability to pay, they come more often to our clinics, which is a much better and much more efficient and cost-saving place to deliver care. So prior to minutes of the population having insurance, their only way to get health care was to show up in an emergency department because they know no emergency department can turn a patient away. So with this expansion of Medi-Cal, we've had to increase the number of providers, number of physicians that we have seeing patients in the outpatient setting. It's accomplished that task of keeping people out of the emergency department and moving them into a physician's office. This has also caused a shortage of primary care physicians, family practitioners, internists, pediatricians. If you happen to know a pediatrician or internist or family practice that's out there is looking to expand, I'm sure any healthcare provider in all of the Central Valley will take them. There has been a shortage of providers as the growth in the population has seen more physician office visits, which is appropriate. That's where they should be.
We've been talking with Russell Judd. He is the CEO of Kern Medical. The county-run hospital is soon to be adopted by a new hospital authority that will continue to provide care for the community, talking about their new name and a new focus as they move forward in the rapidly changing world of healthcare here in the Valley. Mr. Judd, thanks again for taking the time today.
Thank you for the opportunity to visit and tell about the great things happening here in Bakersfield at Kern Medical.
This is Valley Edition. Regular listeners to NPR are familiar with the concept of the StoryCorps segment. The organization records thousands of conversations between family members and loved ones each year. Now, through the group's StoryCorps Legacy Initiative, the organization is branching out, working with hospice organizations across the country, including Heinz Hospice in Fresno. In this story, Emily Stewart interviews her grandmother, Dorothy Stewart, about approaching the end of her life.
I'm a colorful person. I used to have magenta hair before magenta hair was in like
and
it is
green.
Now. And I had it blue, and I had it a half inch all over my head, and I sprayed it black. I was supposed to be at a reception. I walked in the door, and one of my friends screamed her head off.
Describe what Grandpa Bill looked like on the first day you met him?
You know what? I didn't like his looks on the first day I met him. He had a little tiny mustache. And then he met me at the dance hall.
How did Bill propose to you?
I was going to beauty college in Fresno. Every weekend I would come home on the bus and he'd pick me up in Tulare and we'd go to a little Mexican restaurant. As we were sitting there eating, he dropped his fork and he said, "I give up." And I said, "What's the matter? What's the matter?" "Well, with my mom trying to get rid of me and you trying to get me, I give up." Then he said, "If you want to get married in a church, it's in 2 weeks. And if you want to go to Las Vegas, it's next weekend." I was kind of anxious to get the old boy. So I decided on the next weekend. Every time I tell this, I always get a giggle from somebody. And years later, when I told it, and he heard me at the first, and he says, "That sounds terrible." And I said it was, and I love every minute of it.
We're going to switch subjects. Are you scared?
Scared of what?
Of dying?
Not at all. I've lived longer than my parents. Bill lived at 83 when they told me I had cancer. I said, "It's okay. I've had my time." When I got the rest of it that was coming in on me, I didn't expect. I don't want to hurt.
Well, I have one last question.
Oh.
And I don't mean to say this in a bad way. How do you want to be remembered?
I'm not easy to forget. If they don't like me, they'll remember me. And if they like me, they'll remember me. So I've got it made in the grave.
I have two questions that I usually ask you in general. Grandma, where are we going? And you say, crazy.
Yeah. God.
And
Emily,
how are you feeling?
Mean and ornery.
Perfect. Those are the two things that I need to know.
That piece was recorded in partnership between StoryCorps Legacy and Heinz Hospice and produced by KVPR's Ezra David Romero. StoryCorps is a national nonprofit whose mission is to preserve and share humanity's stories in order to build connections between people and create a more just and compassionate world. StoryCorps Legacy supports the stories of people affected by serious illness. StoryCorps.org. From Bakersfield to Fresno and beyond, the San Joaquin Valley has a rich and a gifted jazz community. Some amazing artists have come out of Central California, and there are many opportunities to hear great live music and live jazz. One of them is coming up on Saturday with a concert coming up at Fresno's Arte Americas. One of the men behind this project is joining us in our studio right now, local bassist Richard Giddens.
Hey, how
Richard,
are
welcome.
You? Hey, Joe. How you doing this morning?
Very well, thank you. You're bringing an artist from L.A. to perform here with a really top-notch group of local musicians as part of the Jazz Gallery series at Arte Americas. This has been a project you've been doing for a while now. I want to ask you about that, but first tell me about your guest artist, Gary Novak.
Oh, Gary's an incredible drummer, gifted sweetheart. We met a long time ago, and when I was in high school doing a performance with Roosevelt School of the Arts at the largest jazz educators conference in Atlanta. We were lucky enough to go to Atlanta, and I met him backstage when he was playing with Chick Corea, because Gilbert Castellanos, another local Fresnan, took me backstage and got me all access passes for the whole thing because he lied and said I was his cousin. So I was backstage at every concert, meeting everybody and hanging out. And Gary Novak and Chick befriended me, and we ended up hanging and having a really great time. I was 15 at the time. And then we were going to give our concert the next day, and lo and behold, in the front row, Gary and Chick were there.
So what's it like when you're a young musician looking up to these guys, and then you wind up hiring them, essentially, and working with them as peers?
I mean,
you've maintained that friendship and that relationship this whole time.
Well, no, not this whole time. It's funny. I did a gig in December, and Gary was on the gig down in Los Angeles. And we were joking and talking during soundcheck and just having this really great – there was an instant connection chemistry – and we didn't even play a note really yet. and I was outside. I said, so do you want to hear like the super nerdy fanboy story before we play or after? And he goes, just tell me now. I told him the whole story. And then after the concert was over, he literally like picked me up. He goes, man, I knew there was something about you back then, man. So it was very, very, very cool. And he couldn't actually be happier to be coming and playing here and giving back to Central Valley. And
so you're doing this concert Saturday. The show starts at 7. The doors open at 6:30 at Arte Americas in downtown Fresno. You've been doing a number of these there. How did this idea come about, and how has it come together so far?
Well, I've been doing it since about for maybe a year and a half now, almost 2 years. And it kind of came about. I moved back to Central California in, what was that? I don't know, 2013, in the fall of 2013. And there's many great places to play in town, but there's not any place except for a concert hall that you can go where people aren't talking or eating or doing any of those things that people normally don't do if they go to a concert or a show. You know, it's like you can go to many different restaurants and bars and hear incredible music from amazing local talent. But everyone there is, even if there are certain people there to hear the music, there are still people talking. So I created an environment that did not exist in Fresno.
So you have your group and you partner with these sidemen who come in, the guest stars. How does that work? You're a very accomplished bassist, I might add, for our listeners who don't know. You've worked across the world in New York and extensively in L.A., and now you're back here in the Valley. What's that dynamic like, bringing in that guest soloist who maybe you haven't worked with a lot? Is that part of the excitement of being on the stage?
Well, I mean, a big assignment for me is that, you know, selfishly, it's super fun, you know, and it's an incredible thing to do and actually have it live in Fresno, which means a lot to me personally, which is great. But most of the artists that I've brought are people that I've worked with, toured with, recorded with, you know, and having them come in and know that they trust me, that I'm going to bring a band together of musicians that they can just plug right in and bring their book of music, and we play that book of music and turn it out and have a really great time.
So how does that work? Is there a lot of rehearsal involved, or do you study up on these tunes ahead of time? Or
it depends on the artist. Like when Gilad Hexelman came from New York, his book is particularly crazy hard. So we had 3 rehearsals in town without him. And then we rehearsed at soundcheck and kind of went through the tough bits. And we're like, okay, this might not work. You know, excuse me. So that's kind of that. But then in a concert, like, which is going to happen on Saturday, Gary's like, let's just play some tunes and have a great time. Let's just swing everything really hard. It's like, cool, I'm down with that. So we're going to be playing a lot of standards and a lot of jazz hits of that I grew up loving. And, you know, Tom Wilson's coming from Los Angeles, who's a very, very amazing, accomplished tenor saxophone player. And then local legend, urban legend, Craig Von Berg will be playing piano. So you guys are going to be in for a really great show.
It's going to be a lot of fun. It's coming up at Arte Americas in downtown Fresno on Saturday. Gary Novak performing with our in-studio guest, Richard Giddens, who is here today. Richard, what was it like coming back to the Valley after being away for so long?
It was a bit of culture shock for,
because you went off and you did Stomp, the tour nationally, internationally, right? And then having your own jazz group abroad, or not abroad, but out in New York and everywhere else.
Montreal and New York and London and all that stuff. And yeah, I mean, it was a bit of a trip to come back, and it was great because I immediately started teaching, and I didn't know that was something that I actually really loved doing. And I've actually become such a much better musician from having the patience to teach. It's actually slowed my brain down, and it's been a really crazy sort of, you know, reality that I was never expecting that to happen.
Well, if you're looking to hear some great jazz live setting in an environment that really is conducive to listening, it's a great opportunity this Saturday night. Again, it's at Arte Americas, the Jazz Gallery, Gary Novak with Richard Giddens and company. The doors open at 6:30. The show starts at 7. Richard, if people want tickets,
I would just recommend coming at 6:30 and getting tickets at the door. There's going to have little nibbles, and a bar car is going to be open, and it's all ages. So please bring your kids, and it's going to be a great concert. And if you've never come to one of the Arte shows, you're going to realize that we've created something actually very hip and unique to Central California.
We're looking forward to this one and all the ones to follow. Richard Giddens, thanks so much for joining
us today. Thanks so much, Joe.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, or tweet us. We are at KVPR and at Valley Edition. You can also find our podcasts and streaming audio on our website at kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero and reporter Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This has been Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.